Using the solar-powered chariots, the Cerberus warriors and Deckard's men made good time, reaching the settlement inside of 40 minutes despite the rough terrain. The settlement was made up of 5 shacks, along with a deep well at the side of which was a bucket on a rope and pulley system. The roughly constructed buildings had been painted white to reflect the heat of the desert sun, though their sides had been discolored by the grains of sand that the winds had thrown against them over time. As the chariots approached the settlement, Kane waved to Deckard, indicating that he wanted to stop a little way out. Kane hopped from the back of the one he was riding and moved over to Deckard's vehicle.
I think we should go in on foot.
Any special reason, Kane?
I'm seeing 5 dwellings, but no people. Might want to take that as a bad sign.
Fair point. How do you want to approach this, then?
Grant and I will go in. We're both wearing armor. Think you can spare a couple of your men to cover our backs?
I'll go myself if you want.
You stay here. If there's any trouble, I just as soon have a trained mag leading my backup.
As you wish.
A few moments later, Kane, Grant, and 2 of the fiercely masked incarnates walked the last 150 yards to the settlement. As they got closer, Grant pointed out 2 goats tethered beside one of the buildings, sheltering in its shadow from the bright sunlight. Kane scanned the horizon, watching the buildings for movements. A corral at the far side of the hamlet held a single, tired horse, chestnut brown, with sweat foaming on its flanks. The Sin-Eater pistol slid into Kane's hand. He held it pointing straight down in a safety position as he stepped between the closest 2 buildings.
Anyone home?
Having discarded his heavy coat, the shadow suit molded to Grant's muscular body as he walked carefully ahead of Kane, eyes alert, his own Sin-Eater in hand. Following the 2 X-Mags, the incarnates took up wary positions, their silver staff-like weapons held ready. Giving a signal to Grant, Kane took a step toward the nearest building. He stood to one side, out of the potential line of fire. For a moment, all was silent.
Hello? I'm not here to hurt you. Can you open the door?
Kane and Grant shared a look, and everything that needed to be said between them passed in that silent instant. Grant took up a defensive position, targeting the doorway with his Sin-Eater as Kane stepped back.
I'm coming in. For your safety, I'm going to enter on the count of 3. I must warn you that both my partner and myself are armed. 1, 2, 3.
Nothing appeared to greet them. Through the doorway, away from the intense desert sunshine, all that could be seen was darkness. Kane stood there a moment, his Sin-Eater trained on the open doorway, waiting for his eyes to adjust. After a moment, not needing to inform Grant, he stepped forward. Kane was 2 steps into the room, his eyes narrowed, staring into the greeny blackness of the shadowed room as his eyes began to make out its details. There was a window to one side, but a heavy drape had been drawn across it, with only the thinnest lances of sunlight seeping through around its right edge. Kane could make out furniture, a simple wooden table, several chairs, a box of some sort, crate or chest, he wasn't sure, against one wall. There was another door farther into the room, probably leading to the bedroom of the tiny single-story dwelling. Kane felt Grant's presence behind him as the imposing man stepped into the room. He looked back and saw Grant sweep the room in a single glance before gesturing to the far door with his Sin-Eater. Kane nodded, stepping toward the door quietly.
Hello. I'm coming in. I must warn you that both my partner and myself are armed.
There were 3 people in the room, what looked like a husband and wife with their newborn child. All 3 were dressed in the old, worn clothing of farmers, leading a tough but honest life. The child was tiny, no more than a month old, lying in its crib. As Kane looked more closely, however, he saw that the baby was dead. The husband and wife seemed oblivious to each other's presence in the room. They had also been oblivious to Kane and Grant's entrance. Kane took a step closer, trying to make sense of their words, but nothing seemed to stick. He lowered his Sin-Eater, but kept it gripped in his hand.
My name is Kane. I'm here to help.
They didn't even look at him. Their movements were just twitches, flinches, looking around like crows pecking for spilled seeds on the ground.
Kane, use the comtact.
Their comtacts were capable of real-time translation of the many known languages that they had been programmed with, and as such, their intelligence systems could generally discern a degree of meaning from any spoken language. But the comtact could make no sense of these people.
Nothing. The Comtech doesn't know it. It's freaking me out.
Perversely, the couple apparently remained completely unaware of Kane's and Grant's intrusion. They were like mechanical things, going through their actions with no sense of reality, no break in their movements. Kane stepped across the room, and his hand reached up to draw back the heavy drape that blocked out the harsh sunlight. He pushed back a single drape, letting the light fill the room. The couple's reaction was, at most, muted. Kane thought that they turned toward the window for a moment, but he couldn't be sure. It may have been coincidence, and their robotic movements just continued with unceasing motion. Grant stepped closer, and he held his face close to the woman's as she sat at the edge of the bed, blinking in long, sleepy sweeps of her eyelids.
Their eyes, Kane. There's nothing there.
We're on the right trail.
Kane activated his contact.
Baptiste, you'd better come on over here. I think this needs some medical expertise. Bring Keb and tell Descartes to bring in a little muscle, too. Whatever's eating these people up is making them tough to restrain.
Are they violent?
Not so far, but we may have got here after that part of the cycle had passed. There's some signs of violent activity. One old guy tossed his dinner into the wall.
Maybe he saw a roach jump on it.
That would assume that he had eyes at the time.
The other buildings yielded 5 more adults and 3 children, all of them in a similar state to the young people. There were still 9 living in the settlement, Kane realized, and time clearly took a heavy toll on the victims of whatever they had stumbled upon. He postulated that these people would not last more than a few hours. As they waited outside for the others to join them, Grant surveyed the little settlement.
You have to wonder what these people lived on.
One of the incarnates, a man in an adder's helm, turned to him and indicated the land all around.
Oh, people mistake the desert for a bad place to live. There's wildlife here, fauna, flora. The lack of rainfall doesn't make it a dead environment.
Guess not. Still seems pretty damn rugged to me.
We both grew up as Ville boys. Different frame of reference.
Yeah, the people out here keep goats, sheep, chickens sometimes. They treasure their independence away from the barrens, much as my people.
Bridget came to join them at the outskirts of the hamlet with Descartes and 6 burly incarnates, slick with sweat in the afternoon sun. Bridget had pulled her damp red-gold hair from her face with a linen headband, and its color caught the sun like a halo around her beautiful porcelain-skinned face.
Where's the patient?
Kane pointed to each of the lightly colored buildings in turn.
Take your pick. We got a crazy babbling couple behind door number 1 here. Then behind door number 2, we have a crazy babbling young man and his babbling teenage daughter, closely followed by a babbling couple and their 2 babbling kids over there behind door number 3.
And 4 and 5?
Well, that's where it gets exciting. House number 4 is empty, though it looks like someone went through it with a sledgehammer. Then over at number 5, we have the old dead guy who had a fight with his dinner. It looks like they both lost.
Bridget and Keb had decided to split the duties of examining the crazed people in the little settlement, taking opposite sides of the street and leaving the dead man to last. Incarnates had gone with each of them, while Kane and Grant took a closer look at the empty 4th house. Kane's description, that someone had been through it with a sledgehammer, didn't seem so far from the truth. The people had a meager life, with few possessions or adornments to their little houses. But what little was in this shack had been overturned, tossed aside, thrown against walls, broken and destroyed, almost as if a whirlwind had traveled through the dwelling.
Someone looking for something, maybe?
Well, it just looks to me like destruction for the sake of destruction.
Maybe they couldn't find what they were looking for, or maybe they wanted to cover their tracks.
I don't buy it. Look at the way these people live. They don't have anything worth stealing.
There's always something worth stealing to somebody. And if nothing else, there's always that perennial favorite, the virgin sacrifice.
This is more like someone was having a fit. Epilepsy times 1,000.
Then where's our epileptic?
I don't know. But let's see if Bry's satellite surveillance found anything.
He activated his contact.
Bry, this is Kane. Do you think you could zero in on my reading and search the immediate area? We're looking for one or more stragglers who've left this settlement not more than, say, 3 hours ago, most likely on foot.
On it, Kane.
Kane stood there a moment, gazing out the back window at a wooden kennel. The kennel, he saw, was empty. While they waited for Bry's report, Kane and Grant made their way out of the shack. They walked across the dusty street to see if Bridget had made any progress. The couple in the first house had become more agitated since Kane had last seen them. The man was standing now, swaying to and fro in one corner of the room. Bridget was trying to keep the woman still as she examined her with whatever medical equipment Keb had to spare.
Anything?
Bridget's emerald eyes shot up from the examination of the woman to take him in.
They're showing the same symptoms as the young woman Descartes' crew found yesterday. We're seeing it earlier, but I'd accept that it's the same disease.
Disease?
Infection, then. Kane, I don't know.
They sound louder than earlier.
This man closed his mouth long enough for me to get a decent body temp reading. Their temperature is rising rapidly. He's already at 103.
They're burning up. The baby already boiled, and they're following suit.
Shit deal. Everyone loses.
Grant led the way from the cramped bedroom and out of the shack. Bridget and Kane followed. The incarnates continued their search operation.
What is that they're shouting about?
I don't know, Grant. I couldn't make sense of it.
Neither could the contact.
I haven't been so freaked out in a long time.
It's just babble, nonsense words. The translation program tries to pick up specific sounds, but it's a deception. There's nothing there, just noise.
The girl, the pregnant one in the tent, she was just humming, you remember?
Could be the same thing, petering out at the end as they get closer to expiring. What about the old man? You said he was alive when you found him.
Nothing, no noise.
He was alive for maybe 2 minutes max before we lost him. He was dead by the time I joined Grant in the room.
It's glossolalia.
It's what?
Glossolalia. At least I think that's what it is. They used to think it was some religious thing, communing with the Lord. They called it speaking in tongues. But it's just a chemical imbalance, the brain not getting enough of one thing and too much of another.
So what are you saying, Baptiste? That these dust farmers have got a big dose of that and it's messed up with their balance of this? Because if that's the case, we need to know where the that is coming from.
It doesn't take much. Voices, visions in the head, nonsense speak. These are all things you find in chronic anorexics. Stop supplying your body with protein for long enough and it begins to eat at itself. Back in the 14th century, French nuns used to starve themselves to achieve this very effect.
Did they get hot?
Well, fever's a possibility, but not to the kind of extent that we're seeing. I mean, this isn't even fever. This is like an explosion of energy from inside the body, completely using it up, wearing it out. It's like nothing I've ever heard of.
So are we looking at two things that happen to be hitting people at the same time, or one thing with multiple symptoms?
Medically? I think it's all one thing. It's the same essential effect, manifesting in different ways. Kane, Grant, these people are just being used up at a fantastic rate. That's the only way I can think to describe it.
Grant nodded and Kane glanced ruefully at the closed bedroom door for a moment before turning his gaze back to Bridget.
That's something I can understand. Awful, but it makes sense. So, one, where did it originate? Two, is it catching? Three, how do we stop it?
Bridget checked her pockets for a moment before realizing that the thermometer was still inside the shack.
Let me go grab the thermometer and we'll figure out some kind of plan of action with Keb.
Eaten up from the inside. What a way for a baby to go.
Those people are next, and if we don't move fast, we could follow them.
Thanks for putting that positive spin on things, Kane.
What the hell was that?
Kane, you have company!
Bridget emerged from the shack to join them.
Another quake, maybe?
What is it, Domi? What do you see?
They had left Domi, along with four of the fierce incarnates, guarding Smarts, Rosalia, and the chariots. Over 100 yards from the little settlement, Domi was able to provide a better tactical viewpoint of the area.
I have no... It's big, it's humanoid, and there's just one of them. Beyond that, your guess is as good as mine.
Where?
Northmost corner, behind the farthest house, in the corral!
Kane ran forward, his body held low, arms pumping as he raced along the short stretch between the shacks. Just behind him, his partner followed, but Kane held up his empty left hand to tell the men to hold back. A second later, Kane rounded the corner of the farthest shack, and then he saw it. The creature stood 8 feet tall, its legs bent, slightly hunched, its back to Kane. Its proportions matched its height, a huge hulking figure with thick protrusions coming from its elbows and running down its spine. Its arms and legs were as thick as tree trunks. It was wrapped in some kind of gauze material, an off-white color, stained with dirt and blood, torn in parts to reveal patches of coal-black skin. And Kane saw what he at first took to be a cloud of small flies and insects hovering around it. Kane stood there, pistol raised, watching for a startled moment as the creature slapped the horse aside. It remained there for a moment, its back to Kane.
Dummy, where did it come from? Did you see?
It was just there, like it's Matran's in or something.
Kane?
Kane looked and saw that Grant was pointing to the little well that sat on the edge of the settlement. Its mouth had become bigger, one side distended where the walls had caved in from heavy turmoil below ground. Kane nodded once before turning his full attention back to the beast.
We think it came from the underground. Burrower of some kind.
Slowly the creature turned, as though sensing Kane's presence at last. Head low, it looked at the two ex-mags where they stood beside the edge of the shack. Its face was black like shadow, and twin green eyes burned within. Smoke billowed from those eyes, streams of rising chartreuse vapor dissipating just above its head. Other parts of it seemed somehow ethereal too, now that Kane had got past his initial shock, and he had the chance to assess it more carefully. It wasn't a cloud of insects that hovered about it. The dark cloud was made from aspects of the creature itself. Its face smoldered. Where the gauze coverings were broken, its exposed skin flaked away like burning ashes. And yet, it never seemed to lose any body mass. The thing remained huge and imposing, staring at Kane with those vibrant, unearthly eyes.
What the hell is that thing?
Bridget and the Incarnates were just behind them now, staring in astonishment at the huge figure.
Kane, I think we need to get out of here.
Weapons up.
Suddenly, the creature raced across the sand toward Kane and Grant at a furious pace. Kane and Grant moved backward as the creature ran at them.
Domi, we're gonna need backup. Get over here now.
The hulking brute stopped, and its arm cut through the air and crashed into the wooden shack.
Hostile.
Kane's party spread out around him, holding the monster in their weapon sights. Deckard was coming out of another shack now, accompanied by Keb and three Incarnates, with two more rushing down the street to take up defensive positions with their tubular silver staffs.
Domi, get over here!
Kane, we have a second problem. The Mexican and the girl just slugged me. Our rabbits are on the run.
Kane rushed backward on light feet, gun at the ready, eyes never leaving the huge creature that loomed before him. Behind him, Grant, Bridget, and the Incarnates took up defensive positions, finding what meager cover they could in doorways and between the ramshackle buildings.
Domi, repeat message. Did you say we've lost the prisoners?
Worse than that. They took the interphaser.
Damn. Can you see them? Do you know what direction they went in?
Closer now, Kane could see that the monster's legs featured a reverse knee, like a grasshopper's or a horse's hind leg. And it seemed to totter forward as though set to overbalance at any moment.
Kane, they took two chariots and headed off to the west, I think.
Kane, head in the game, stat!
The hulking creature began running toward them once more, arms out and back as it prepared to swing for Kane. Kane spun backward, dropping low as the monster's right arm rocketed toward his throat. A cloud of black flecks floated through the air. Kane stumbled backwards and fell. He looked up as the creature towered over him, tossing its head back. This close, Kane could see a pattern on the creature's face and exposed skin. It had ridges of scales like those of a fish or reptile. It looked at Kane on the ground. He scrambled to get away. The creature turned toward Grant and his Sin Eater. Behind Kane, Deckard and the Incarnates followed Grant's cue. From all sides of the tiny street, beams of energy zapped toward the huge beast as the Incarnates fired high-density energy beams from their silver-colored staffs. The energy beams were almost invisible in the sunlight, just lighter streams across a watcher's vision, like sunspots playing across the eyes. Deckard, too, was using his old weapon of office, a reconditioned Sin-Eater hand blaster similar to those carried by Kane and Grant. He crouched on one knee to steady himself, his free hand under the muzzle of the compact weapon. Under the barrage of fire, the hulking creature reared to its full impressive height, 8 feet of solid jet-black muscle. It struggled against the onslaught, shook momentarily as though flicking raindrops from its skin, then turned its gaze on the multiple attackers, its fierce eyes smoldering. Still closest to it on the pavement, Kane aimed his Sin Eater up and targeted the creature's chin between jaw and neck. Then Bridget Baptiste was in the sand next to him, pulling him away.
What are you doing, Baptiste? I can make the shot.
You're too close, Kane. Let's put some distance between us and that thing before it's too late.
Fuming, Kane struggled to his feet and followed Bridget down the little street as the Incarnates, Deckard, and Grant covered his back, holding the monster at bay.
I was about to turn that to my advantage. I could have done it.
You would have been dead.
The red-headed woman checked around the corner of the building, her TP-9 pistol in hand. Kane followed her, watching as the translucent beams from the incarnate staffs blasted into the monster, tentatively holding it in place.
Did you hear Domi's report?
Yes! One problem at a time, Kane!
No. We need to get after them. Smarts and Rosalia are our only leads to Karnak's gang, and they have our interphaser now, too.
They'll never get it working!
Oh, sure. You can build another one, right? You and Brewster?
Kane, can we just deal with the monster first?
Kane stepped back, holding a hand to one ear to better hear his contact over the ruckus all around him.
Tell me if it gets close. Domi, I need you to go after those two right now.
A little more than 100 yards away, Domi was wincing as she rubbed at a bump that was forming on the back of her skull. Three of the incarnates who accompanied her now lay unconscious, while the fourth had removed his bird-faced helmet and was using water from his leather drinking pouch to rinse a bloody cut just above his eye.
Domi, I need you to go after the duo right now.
No need to shout.
What's that? Domi, we've got a lot going on here right now.
I'll get on it. It's just my head, you know?
Don't let them get away. How are the incarnates?
We got three unconscious and at least one wounded here, not including myself. Kane, I swear to you, that girl moved like lightning.
I'll send backup to follow you as soon as I can.
Hey, people, I can double back and join Domi in 2 minutes.
Sounds good, Grant.
Stay where you are, and I'll pick you up, hotshot.
Domi ran to one of the untended chariots. Once aboard, she started flipping switches until she found the engine ignition. Domi swung the chariot around and steered it toward the east flank of the little hamlet where the rest of her teammates were battling the monster. The incarnates continued to blast the tall creature with energy beams from their staffs, and it reared back. Then it seemed to shrug, flicking the beams aside like insects. Grant, who had taken a position close to the beast, tucked inside the doorway of one of the roughly constructed shacks.
Here it comes!
Grant pulled his weapon back and withdrew into the shelter of the doorway as the creature rushed past him, a trail of black flakes of skin floating on the air behind it like ashes. It ignored him and ran straight past Descartes as he followed the same procedure, ducking between the buildings as the monster raced at its attackers. The two nearer incarnates danced away, rushing to their own shelters as the creature charged them. The two at the far end of the street remained, attempting to hold the monster at bay with their staffs. To the side of the street, Kane and Bridget ducked back as the black-faced monster lunged into view. Its huge left arm swung out toward the side of the far building. Its other arm reached forward as the two incarnates ran for cover, and it snagged one of them by his reptile-styled helmet. The incarnate was dragged across the ground toward the huge creature. Standing just 6 feet away, Kane leveled his Sin Eater between the monster's shoulder blades. Bullet struck the monster's hard carapace, but it didn't even seem to react. Instead, it continued to pull the adder-masked incarnate toward its face, lifting him high off the ground. Its grip tightened over the incarnate's wooden mask. The other incarnates had emerged from their hiding places to blast at the monster with their powered staffs once more.
Pull back! Don't get too close to that thing!
Kane turned to Bridget.
We have to do something.
The pair of them were now the closest to the attack. Bridget nodded once, taking a two-handed grip on her TP-9 before stepping away from the wall of the shack to get better aim at the hulking brute. A blur of wood and reflected sunlight raced toward the monster. It was Domi, riding one of the incarnate's solar-powered chariots at top speed. She had to have doubled around the tiny bill to get her speed up, Kane realized, as the athletic albino woman leaped from the vehicle and away from the monster. The top of the chariot reached roughly to its waist. The collision smashed the wooden frame of the vehicle. The monster seemed to spin in place, its reverse-hinged legs kicking up great clumps of sand. In a few seconds, the creature was gone. Kane cautiously approached the hole left behind in the dry ground, a roughly circular tunnel that appeared to go straight down. He kept his Sin Eater trained on the opening in the sand for a long moment. Grant jogged up the street toward them, his blaster held high in the standard ready position. Incarnates were helping each other, while Descartes helped Domi up from her tumble on the sand where she had leaped from the moving chariot.
Whatever it was, it's gone, Kane.
If we don't follow it, we'll lose it.
Down there? Forget it. Our weapons weren't doing anything. You'll just get yourself killed.
Yeah, you're right, Baptiste. We need a battle plan.
Medic! Medic!
All eyes turned and saw that the reptile-masked incarnate was lying like a rag doll, his limbs at awkward angles, blood streaming over the cracked plates of his ornate helmet. Five miles away, two stolen chariots raced over the dunes. Smarts was still trying to comprehend what had occurred. One moment they were standing with the petite albino woman and four of the animal-masked guards, watching as something humanoid yet inhuman attacked the tiny ville barely 100 yards from them. The next moment, the deadly Rosalia was a flurry of motion. As she took out the incarnate, Smarts had leaped for the carrying case of the interfacer, grabbing it from the rear step of an open-back chariot and swinging the solid box around until it connected with the back of the albino woman's head. Smarts remembered standing in awe as he looked at the devastation that Rosalia had caused in a matter of seconds. Four well-built armed men had fallen to her blows. He himself had taken out their female jailer. Now Smarts checked behind him, confirming that the swells and drops of the uneven desert had given them cover from the settlement and its monster. He held his hand aloft, indicating to Rosalia that they needed to halt.
We're not far enough from them!
We don't know where we're running!
Smarts took out his pocket cron.
Where are we?
Not far from a safe house. Just let me work out...
He began the calculations in his head.
What was that thing? Did you see?
I saw it.
What was it?
I have no idea. It would appear that Señor Kane and his compadres involved themselves in many things that I do not as yet understand.
It looked like it was attacking them.
She and Smarts had begun their attack almost as soon as the monstrous thing had begun to move, just after it had swatted the horse aside, when all their captors' attention was focused on it. They had not stayed around long enough to see what happened next. It was simple speculation from Rosalia. Even so, Smarts nodded slowly in agreement. He had seen the thing shriek as it turned to face the three magistrate men and their troops. He was fairly certain that he could guess what had followed.
We need to circle around. There's a dugout entrance in this direction, 3¾ miles, but we can't leave tracks like these. It will lead Señor Kane and his people straight to us.
We dump these primitive vehicles then. They've given us some distance already. I'll run the rest.
She hoisted the carrying case and stepped from the chariot, passing him the procured silver staff.
You might be able to do so, dear sweet Rosalia, but I am afraid that it is more than little beyond my capabilities.
Follow at your own speed.
She began running in the direction he had indicated.
I will bring reinforcements as soon as I can.
We may not need them if that monster was successful.
Rosalia's long stride seemed to eat up the desert, and Smarts watched as her right arm pumped forward and back with each graceful stride. In her left, she held the solid carrying case away from her body, careful not to knock it into her leg as she ran toward the horizon. Reluctantly, Smarts glanced at the sun beating down overhead before beginning the long walk in the same direction as his colleague. Keb and Descartes were the first to tend to their fallen colleague, while Bridget and Kane followed. When Keb removed the crocodile mask, the wounded incarnate's face was a tapestry of blood. A shard of wood was jabbed through his cheek, and he would be unable to close his jaw until it was removed.
What the hell did we just see, Descartes?
I don't know, Kane. All I know is that I have a man down here. When I brought you into this, I didn't know that thing was going to turn up.
You've got four more wounded. There was a prison break while we were all involved with the floor show here.
Damn.
Descartes glanced at his team over by the chariots. Bridget laid a consoling hand on his shoulder.
I'll take a look at them.
She strode toward the other wounded men. A moment later, Descartes followed. Kane watched for a few more seconds as Keb worked on the injured incarnate. His wounds looked bad. Kane shook his head, trying to clear his thoughts before he turned to Domi and Grant, who waited by the side of the nearest building.
What now, Kane?
Didn't I tell you to get after Smarts and Rosalia?
Whoa, you may want to back down a little there, partner. Domi just damn near saved all our lives with that little stunt she pulled in the chariot.
Yeah... Sorry, Domi. I'm just not happy about losing that whatever it was.
We're all pretty pissed. You got pretty close, though, Kane. Get a good look at it?
Kane pointed off vaguely into the distance.
We'll talk about it later. First, you and Domi get our jackalopes back.
Right.
Domi and Grant ran off in the direction of the chariots.
Descartes, we're gonna need to borrow two chariots.
We'll be down to five, and I still have a 15-man crew to take care of out here.
We'll bring them back!
As they followed the wheel ruts left by their prisoner's escape, Grant activated his contact.
Cerberus, this is Grant. Fix on my position and give me a satellite sweep.
Grant, this is Brewster. What can I do for you?
Brewster Philboyd was another recent addition to the trusted inner circle of the Cerberus operation. Philboyd was an astrophysicist by discipline, aged somewhere in his mid-40s. A scientist first and a fighter very much last, Philboyd worked shifts at many of the desk jobs, helping out where he could at the Cerberus Redoubt.
Long story short, our two prisoners have absconded on solar-powered chariots on a westerly heading. They won't have got far. Can you find them?
There was a pause, and Grant imagined that Philboyd was working the computer keys to access the data.
Bear with me.
Grant's chariot crested another hillock of sand.
I've got one. Turn a little more to the north, and you'll see two abandoned chariots, maybe 2 miles ahead of you. There's a figure making its way from these toward the west.
Keep scanning. There should be a second one out there.
As their chariots reared up another of the steep dunes, Domi spotted them.
I see them, Grant! The buggies!
Grant saw the two little dark blots on the landscape. He throttled up, feeding his own chariot more power, urging the little vehicle ahead.
I spotted a second figure moving at some speed in the same basic direction. He's put quite a distance between himself and the first.
She.
Grant somehow knew it was Rosalia. There was something about that damn woman that was more than anyone had expected at first glance. Domi looked across from her chariot.
I'll take the nearest. You keep on, okay?
They whipped past the abandoned chariots and could see the struggling figure of Senor Smarts as he used the staff to walk briskly away to the west, glancing over his shoulder every dozen or so paces. When he saw Domi's and Grant's chariots, he began running, changing his direction and heading for a dead tree that sprouted from the hard-packed ground to his left. Grant ignored him, standing high in the chariot as he continued off to the west, determined to catch up with Rosalia. His head flicked to his left as Domi's chariot peeled out of formation and she prepared to chase Smarts down.
Be careful, Domi.
Grant raced away, narrowed eyes scanning the horizon. Domi's chariot bore down on the running Mexican.
Keep away from me, Señorita Magistrate!
Smarts ducked behind the dried trunk of the tree. Domi leaped from the chariot as it slid to a stop in the sand. She saw now that the man before her had a familiar silver staff in his hand, one of the Incarnate's strange weapons, and he was frantically fiddling with the controls as he tried to work the stolen thing. Domi's hand reached for the Detonic's combat master tucked into her waistband. She brought it up in a fluid movement.
Drop it!
Smarts ignored her, finding the correct button at last. The blast went up into the air, shimmering like heat haze. Then Smarts brought the staff down, aiming its near-invisible beam at the albino woman. Domi rolled, moving herself out of the beam as it cleaved the air toward her. The staff swayed in his hands, blasting energy in a crazy arc.
Next one takes your head off those scrawny shoulders! No fooling!
Smarts tried to swing the staff around, the burning pain of the bullet wound throbbing in his leg.
Drop it!
His hazel eyes looked down the length of his body, seeing the strange albino crouched there, poised with her pistol now aimed between his legs. He flipped the switch on the side of the silver staff. He tossed it to one side, raising his hands in the air.
I had to try. It's the rules of the game, is it not, Señorita?
Domi's ruby eyes narrowed as she held the gun on him.
Just don't move.
Back at the desert hamlet, Bridget Baptiste and Keb, the field medic, had rounded up all the wounded incarnates in the shade of one of the shacks and were checking on each in turn. The four incarnates who had been with Domi when Smarts and Rosalia made their break for freedom were okay, barring a few scrapes and bruises, and one of them had had his bloodied nose packed and padded with gauze. A fifth incarnate, the man who had tussled with the monster itself, lay unmoving. The other incarnates had helped shift all of the strangely altered locals into one shack so that they could be more easily guarded and monitored. In another of the shady rooms within the shack, Bridget and Keb compared notes on the strangely disoriented people. Their conclusion was depressingly familiar.
We're no closer to knowing what this thing is.
We need to do a proper laboratory examination.
Using what? We don't even have a means of transport right now.
A temporary setback.
These people don't have a lot of time, Kane.
Keb, how far are we from Otten?
I see what you're thinking, Kane, but Descartes wouldn't allow it.
You have facilities there. We need to nail down what this thing is.
No, Kane. Keb's right. We made a deal with Descartes that he wouldn't have to take this back home with him.
Ah, damn!
Keb rushed outside to see what the disturbance was. A look passed between Bridget and Kane before they followed.
Ah!
Outside, at the shady spot by the wall of the shack, the four wounded incarnates had all moved away from their companion, the one who had been tossed aside by the dark-skinned monster less than 30 minutes before. The man was tossing around like a beached fish, his bent body flipping despite his broken limbs. Descartes rushed across from where he had been examining the tunnel at the edge of the settlement.
What happened to him?
He just started screaming, moving around. It's like he woke up all of a sudden.
Kane stepped closer, looking at the fallen man as he writhed on the ground.
It's okay. Help's here. We have painkillers.
Get off the planet, ape thing. Make room.
Kane crouched, using his left forearm to hold the writhing man still. With his right hand, the X-Mag reached for the man's face.
Kane, what the hell do you think you're doing?
Kane ignored Descartes, snatching at the man's forehead to hold his head down. He shifted his weight, holding the writhing incarnate as still as he was able. With a swift movement of his hands, Kane grabbed the man's head and shoved him back, right hand reversed, its heel pushing against the man's forehead. With the fingers of his right hand, Kane dragged at the indentations below the man's eyebrows, forcing him to open his eyes. Kane remained there a moment, looking at the man's eyes. Kane's head turned to Descartes, Bridget, and the others as they moved closer.
Look. Look at his eyes.
Where the incarnate's eyes had been a dark chocolate brown before, now they were a light tan. Their color was fading away. Damp with sweat, the wispy silk of her dancing costume clung to Rosalia's toned body as she ran across the desert. Her shapely tanned legs stretched out, eating into the distance with seeming effortlessness. Her right arm pumped back and forth, the hand held rigid, cutting the air like a blade, while her left hand clung to the handle of the little metallic carrying case of the interphaser unit. Despite the hot afternoon sun, Rosalia showed no signs of tiring. A sheen of sweat glistened on her body. Her dark eyes were fixed ahead, looking for the signs that Senor Smarts had promised she would recognize. She had never been to this dugout before, at least not on foot, and she was certain that it would be easy to miss. Tom Karnak's gang knew the value of keeping things hidden from prying eyes, even out here in the middle of nowhere. When you were a trader, it didn't pay to advertise where you stored your goods. As her long legs continued to kick forward, racing for the western horizon, she spotted the stump of a dead tree off to her right, barely poking from the ground. She angled her run toward it, slowing as she approached. Rosalia put down the interphaser and stood there a moment, looking at the little stump. It rose just a few inches above the sand, the bulk of the tree snapped off and long since removed. The brown bark had been blackened by smoke where someone had burned the tree's remains, and Rosalia knelt a moment, scrutinizing the burn marks carefully. There, to one side, carved into the blackened stump so that it showed as a pale yellow streak, was a symbol, a circle, irregular in its hasty carving, with parallel lines scored across it at an angle.
Karnak.
Rosalia glanced back to where she had come from, up at the sun, shifting a little lower in the sky as the afternoon progressed. Then she looked back at the tiny carving and judged what direction it pointed. All she needed to do was head in the same direction as the carving indicated, a straight line all the way to the horizon until she found the hideout. But if she misjudged, deviated even a little from that route, she ran the risk of passing the base, never finding the hidden entrance. Scanning the landscape to the west, where the carving indicated, Rosalia saw a low outcropping forming a muddy brown lump against the blue sky. She shielded her eyes from the sun, narrowing them to get a better look. Up there, circling overhead, she saw a family of buzzards looking for scraps. That would be it. Karnak's base. Picking up the carrying case by its handle once more, Rosalia resumed her jog toward the rocky outcropping. With no markers around it, it was hard to guess how far away the rocks were, but she estimated it was perhaps a mile. Grant urged the solar-powered chariot to even greater speeds.
She can't have gone much farther than this.
His vehicle sped over another dune. He then spotted the tiny figure in the distance. She was just a speck amid the dirty yellow sands. He turned the chariot toward the dark speck, smiling as the dot became recognizable as a human form, the thin lines of the legs and arms protruding from the torso.
Now I've got you.
As Grant got closer, he confirmed that the figure was Rosalia. He saw then that she was holding the square case that glinted in the sun. Raising his gaze, Grant stared ahead, trying to discern where she was running to. There was nothing there, just a little outcropping, perhaps two stories high and stretching maybe 30 feet along the sand. It was hardly a great hiding place. At best, the dancer might have hoped to use it for shade until the sun went down and she could travel more comfortably. Of course, she had the interphaser, but Grant reassured himself that she couldn't have figured out the operating protocols involved from just a single observation of the unit in use. Smarts, he accepted, might just be wily enough to get the unit working by a process of trial and error, but he couldn't imagine Rosalia getting it operational by anything other than luck. In short, all she could do now was run, and there was nowhere to hide. Grant knew it, and he was sure she did as well. As she neared the rocks, Rosalia noticed that she was being followed. She glanced over her shoulder and quickened her pace automatically. There, racing across the dry dirt, a plume of sand tossed up in his wake, was the dark-skinned magistrate aboard one of the little electric chariots. He was a huge figure, standing erect over the low-set console of the twin-wheeled buggy. The trace of a smile crossed Rosalia's lips for a moment, bunching the pleats of skin at the corners of her eyes. She spun back, standing still for several seconds as she let Grant get just a little bit closer.
Too late now, magistrate man.
Mwah. A second later, she trotted into the shade of the outcropping and was lost to the solid black shadow that it cast. Back at the settlement, Kane shifted his hand from the incarnate's head and stepped slowly away from him. The wounded incarnate continued to toss and turn, his head weaving backward and forward, as though taking punches. Kane turned to Descartes, his face stern and impenetrable.
Well?
What is it? What's going on?
Virus.
No, Kane. No virus I know talks back. He called you an ape thing?
Yeah. Sounds kind of like the bull Enlil and his cohort spout.
The Anunnaki? This doesn't look...
Nothing those lizards do ever looks like what we expect. Nothing they do conforms to what we think they'll do. Every time we think we've beaten them down, it turns out they've got another trick just waiting to be played.
Keb looked to Bridget for reassurance before he spoke.
Kane, for those of us who came in late, perhaps...
I think this is an Anunnaki virus that overwhelms people's minds.
A mind virus? Could such a thing exist? Keb... Bridget?
Hypothetically, but how would such a thing be spread?
That creature touched him.
It touched you too, Kane.
No, it didn't. I was damn close, but we never touched. You made sure of that, Baptiste. And thank you, by the way.
With just one host and everyone who contacts it dying in a matter of hours, this would be a very slow way to intentionally spread a disease, if it is intentional.
He's right. I touched the girl in the tent before she died. Nothing's happened to me.
What about an incubation period? Maybe... Bridget, maybe you're a carrier now.
No. It's affected your man here immediately. And the evidence we've seen is that it's true for everyone else who's come into contact with it. If I had it, you'd all know by now.
You could be immune. Back in Cobaltville, there was a program of immunization against a number of diseases. Since Baron Cobalt turned out to be an Anunnaki in sleeper form, isn't it possible he'd have immunized his loyal subjects with whatever they needed to survive this virus?
Anything's possible, Kane. But we left Cobaltville years ago. Why is this virus, if it is a virus, only showing up now? What held it back? Who's unleashed it? And why?
By mistake, maybe?
Could be just to thin the herd in the outlands outside of Ville walls. The Anunnaki are very into culling the herd. Selective evolution, or whatever you want to call it.
I don't see it. There are too many variables for it to ring true. We're looking too deeply for an answer to something that's likely much more simple.
Slowly, Kane nodded, accepting her point.
The monster's the key, then.
Kane turned away and activated the contact hidden beneath his skin.
Kane to Cerberus, you there?
Yes, Kane.
We've got us a creature of unknown origin, approximately 8 feet tall, jet black skin, appears to be disintegrating with movement.
Kane, Lokesh here. Please describe again.
We think that this creature is the host for the virus or infection that Descartes originally reported. Trouble is, we lost it after the battle. The thing retreated underground. Now this creature moves like lightning, and it's a burrower, so it won't be easy for us to track from the ground. I'm wondering if we can employ the Vela satellite for some surveillance.
In the control room of the Cerberus Redoubt, Lokesh bent over a desk as he considered Kane's request. He looked across to where Brewster Filboid sat at the communications relay desk, an unspoken query on his face. Filboid wore black-rimmed glasses above his acne-scarred cheeks. His pale blonde hair was swept back from a receding hairline, and his lanky 6-foot frame seemed hunched as he sat at the computer terminal uplinked to the satellites and communications relay. Filboid had proved to be a valuable addition to the staff due to his dogged determination to find the cause of a problem or uncover the basic workings of a system. Just now, the unvoiced problem was whether the Vela-class satellite could track a body underground. Filboid nodded after a moment, showing Lakesh a shaky hand that suggested that he would try but could not guarantee results.
Kane, we can try that, but no promises. Do you know in which direction the creature moved off?
Hard to say. As I said, the thing spun itself a tunnel straight down into the ground and disappeared inside. We didn't feel any vibrations underneath us, so it may have gone south, but I can't say for sure.
Mariah Falk and Clem Bryant entered the operations center. Lakesh held his palm up to them as they approached, warning them to remain silent until the communication with Kane was over. He needed to concentrate on every word.
One more thing. Grant's requested some monitoring assistance, too. I can't be watching two places at once, no matter how close you guys are. I'll see if anything leaps up from under the surface, but I'll need to keep with Grant for a while.
Grant's out on his own, so I want you to stick with him. Priority one. Kane out.
Lakesh motioned Mariah and Clem over.
I'm sorry to keep you waiting.
Mariah unfolded her map of Arizona onto Lakesh's desk.
Mariah believes that she's found something.
By all means, let us have a look.
The chariot pulled to a stop beside the rocks. Sin Eater in hand, Grant used the vehicle for cover as he surveyed the area. Up close, he saw that the outcropping was formed of two strips of rocks. The right-hand set towered to about 2 stories, while the others, to his left, were a little lower, just over 8 feet. The strips of rocks formed a narrow corridor, locked in shadow, its floor carpeted by fine sand. Rosalia had disappeared between the two strips, but even from here, Grant could see that there was hardly anywhere to go. The shady corridor between the rocks ran no more than 18 feet. At best, she might hope to ambush him if he entered, but she was unarmed, he knew, and Grant was confident he could take her. Warily, his pistol pointed ahead of him, Grant made his way toward the narrow corridor formed by the rocks. The outcropping cast shade across the landscape, thick black shadows, and Grant took a few moments as his eyes adjusted from the fierce sunlight. Slowly, the shadows of the corridor took on a familiar greenish hue as his eyes filtered out the sun, and he began to discern the details of the rocky walls. The little corridor was tight, not wide enough to take 2 men abreast. Its depth seemed very dark after the harsh desert sun, and Grant stood near the entrance, checking ahead with his gun raised, his eyes flicking left and right, up and down, trying to spy Rosalia. Slowly, Grant took a step forward, edging his back against the higher of the 2 walls. He couldn't see Rosalia, couldn't even sense her presence. He stilled himself, willing his heart to hush as he listened for her breathing. Carefully, Grant continued down the short passageway between the rocks, his eyes flicking to and fro as he searched for the svelte woman. By the time he reached the end of the shady passage, Grant wanted to punch something. She wasn't there, wasn't anywhere. She had ducked into this naturally made alleyway between the rocks. He had seen her blow him a kiss and step into the shade, and then nothing. Grant stepped back into the sunlight. Scanning the horizon, he looked farther to the west to see if she had continued running while he was carrying out his methodical search. There was no one in sight. Warily, his senses heightened and alert, he walked around the outside edge of the lower group of rocks, checking to see if Rosalia had doubled back and hidden here while he was searching the shadowy corridor. He paced back to the chariot, which remained where he had left it. There was no sign of her.
Think in 3 dimensions, Grant.
He reached for the top of the lower group of rocks. He pulled himself up by the powerful muscles of his left arm. The surface of the low rocks was sprinkled with sand and spattered with the white residue of bird droppings, but there was no sign of the woman. Grant took several steps backward until he reached the edge of the outcropping. Then he sheathed the Sin Eater and sprinted across the narrow expanse toward the edge of the higher group of rocks. He climbed up, using his hands and whatever toeholds he could find. Atop the higher outcropping, Grant saw exactly the same thing as he had on the lower group.
Fat lot of nothing. Brewster, I think I've lost my rabbit. Are you able to give me a fix on her?
No can do, Grant. I was watching the whole thing. She went in and you followed. Then you came out. Wherever she isn't running. Is there a cave or caves inside?
Not that I saw.
Senor Smarts had been persuaded at gunpoint to drive one of the chariots back to the settlement, while Domi rode behind him in her own vehicle. They had abandoned the third chariot, trusting that Descartes' men would be able to pick it up once Domi advised them of its location. Smarts limped from the back of the chariot, gripping his leg wound and gritting his teeth against the pain as he hobbled toward the buildings of the settlement. Domi followed, casually holding the Detonic's combat master to the brigand's back.
Hurry up! No time to waste!
I am wounded, you understand?
Yeah! I shot you good, you piece of shit!
Like all magistrates, you have no honor, senorita.
Domi took two steps forward, placing the muzzle of her pistol flush against Smarts' left cheek.
You bopped me in the back of the head with a case!
The color drained from Smarts' face, and his eyes remained on hers as Domi pushed the gun forward. Finally, he staggered back.
My apologies, senorita.
Keep him.
Domi held the gun on him, her fierce ruby orbs eyeing his body as though deciding where to place a bullet. Finally, she stepped back and pulled the gun away, holding it in a more casual grip but still glaring at the wounded man.
You don't want to get on my wrong side anymore. I'm not like Kane and the others. I don't believe in all that honor shit. I'd rather put a bullet between your eyes, little man.
I understand.
Domi held his gaze a moment longer until he finally looked away.
Understand this. When Kane's done with you, you better run. Because there's no good reason why I shouldn't carve a strip off you for blindsiding me. Now move!